A special guest with us is our next speaker. We all know how busy a U.S. Cabinet Secretary's life can be, so having Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack with us today is a very big deal. Secretary Vilsack was sworn in January 2009 as the 30th Secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, where he leads a staff of more than 106,000 employees. You should also know that he got his start in politics in 1987 when he was elected to mayor of Mount Pleasant, Iowa. In 1992, he won election to the Iowa Senate. And in 1998, Secretary Vilsack won election to the first of two terms as governor of our state of Iowa, the first Democrat elected to that office in more than 30 years. And in 2007, he campaigned for the party's nomination for President of the United States. One of the hallmarks of his tenure as secretary has been his effort to revitalize rural America. As chair of the first ever White House Rural Council, Secretary Vilsack and USDA have taken steps to strengthen services for rural businesses and entrepreneurs by finding new ways to partner with other federal agencies and private sector to spur investment in rural America. Also under his leadership, USDA has been promoting American agriculture by conducting cutting-edge research and expanding markets at home and abroad. In fact, 2009 to 2013 represents the strongest 5 years in the history of agricultural trade, which was helped by the approval in 2011 of the Free Trade Agreement with Colombia, Panama, and South Korea. Secretary Vilsack has been a good friend of the U.S. pork industry, and I know he loves a good pork chop or loin sandwich from the Big Grill as much as anyone. In addition to pushing for free trade agreements, which have helped pork producers tremendously, he has directed USDA during his time at the agency to make several supplemental purchases of pork when producers were struggling because of the 2009 H1N1 flu and a couple of years ago during the drought that affected most of the Midwest. The Secretary has agreed to take some questions at the conclusion of his remarks. Before asking your questions, please state your name and the state from where you're from, and we'll let producers ask here because the Secretary will have a press conference at 1:30 in room D downstairs. Now, please help me give a warm welcome to the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Dr. Hill, thanks very much. Very much appreciate the opportunity to be here today, if for no other reason than the lunch I just ate. It's far better than I would have if I had prepared it myself. A great piece of pork, no question about it. And for those of you who have not come to the Iowa State Fair, I suspect there's probably only, Congressman King, maybe one or two people that haven't done that in this room. But if you haven't, you definitely need to stop at the pork tent. So the pork chop on a stick is to die for, no question about it. It's one of the great eating delicacies of the U.S. Well, I'm pleased to be here today to first and foremost thank the pork producers for the extraordinary help and assistance that you all have provided in the passage of our Farm Bill. I think it's fair to say that it's no small feat this day in Washington, D.C. to get major legislation through the process. And indeed, we are excited about the opportunities that this Farm Bill has created for all of American agriculture and all of rural America. We're in the process of working hard to implement the major provisions of that Farm Bill. As you probably know, our first order of business was to put in place our disaster assistance programs again that were restored as a result of congressional action. Appreciate the fact that Congress did that, made it retroactive. So we're now in the position of being able to cover losses that occurred in 2011, 2012, and 2013. Every Friday I get a report of the number of applications for disaster assistance. Last Friday that number exceeded 81,000 applications for assistance, a good many of them for livestock indemnity. We have already issued checks totaling close to $250 million. We anticipate and expect that number ultimately when all is said and done, be close to $2 billion in assistance and help. We worked very hard and are working very hard to get the educational materials out on some of the crop safety net programs. We know that producers across the country have some serious issues and serious discussions and decisions that they're going to have to make in the next several months. So we recently announced roughly $6 million that will go to universities to work on education and web-based decision tools that will allow producers to decide whether ARC or PLC is the program for them. We know that this is, notwithstanding the fact I'm talking to hog producers, my guess is that there are crop producers in this audience who are going to have to make that decision. We know it's a very critical decision you all have to make. We want to provide you with as much information as quickly as we possibly can so you can make an informed decision for your operation. We're going to continue to work on expanding opportunities and strengthen our crop insurance program. Just recently announced our whole farm policy initiative that's going to allow folks who have a multitude of crops being grown on a particular farm to be able to access this new insurance program. So we're excited about the implementation process. One of the things that I'm particularly excited about is the opportunity to establish, as Congress has directed, a research foundation, an opportunity for us to do in agriculture what has been done in healthcare, the ability to leverage and extend research dollars by establishing a foundation that will be run by a board appointed by the Secretary of Agriculture. Up to 15 members will be selected. They will have the responsibility of allocating and making decisions about roughly $400 million that should be available, $200 million of which will come from the federal government. It will be matched by another $200 million, we hope, from the nonprofit and private sector. This 15-member board will then make a decision about where to put resources to work. Agricultural research is extraordinarily important, especially at this time. We live in very much a global economy. And there are many, many positives that accrue from living in a global economy, not the least of which is, as Dr. Hill suggested, record trade levels for American agriculture, which has helped us to stabilize and in many cases reach record levels in terms of farm income. In order for us to continue that, we have to be well aware of the risks that are associated with global trade, which is that from time to time things come into our country which cause some serious challenges for producers. And the hog industry is confronted with one such circumstance today. The coronavirus, in fact, multiple coronaviruses have come into the U.S. and is causing a serious problem for producers. Were I to have given this speech a year ago, Dr. Clifford would have probably advised me that there were a little over 100 producers and operators who were impacted and affected by PED virus. He would have suggested that this was a small number. But in the last year, that number of nearly 100 has grown to 4,700 operations. And we're looking at an increase of somewhere between 150 and 200 operations a week. So this is obviously an expanding issue and one that we, I think, have to come to grips with. We have to deal with it, and we need to deal with it aggressively. Why do we need to deal with it aggressively? Well, first of all, to producers. Producers can't afford, as they have in the past several months, to see millions of pigs die. It is estimated that we've lost roughly 10% of herds already. This not only impacts and affects producer income, it also obviously affects access to product, which in turn limits our export opportunities and in turn limits the amount of pork that's available for consumers. This results in rising consumer costs. Consumers have a choice with their protein selections, and if costs get too high, then choices are made to move away from pork. So this is an issue that's important to us at USDA. We know it's important to the industry. And we're beginning to see, unfortunately and tragically, reinfections occur in some organizations and operations. Now, I want to be clear about this issue, not so much to the people in this room, because what I'm about to say you all know, but there are a number of cameras here today, which I suspect are going to speak to a larger audience. And it is important for that larger audience to know something about these viruses. This is not about human health. This is an animal health issue. It doesn't translate into something that is of concern to consumers, except for the price and the availability of product. So it's very important that consumers understand that what we're talking about here are viruses that impact the health of pigs, not people. Nevertheless, it is something that we at USDA take very seriously. And so today we are beginning an effort to partner with producer groups and producers to begin to better monitor and trace and control the circumstances associated with these viruses. Today, a federal order is being issued, which will require producers, should they be impacted and affected by an infection, to notify us of that fact, and then to take the additional step of notifying their veterinarian or the state veterinarian or the veterinarians associated with our department at USDA, APHIS, so that we can work collaboratively with you to develop a management plan that will allow us better to monitor, trace, and control the circumstance on the farm. We, of course, would expect that that plan would include implementation steps focused on biosecurity practices, which I suspect you're hearing quite a bit about here during this World Pork Expo. This does not involve a restriction of movement. It does not involve a quarantine. But it does involve the need for reporting and the need for a monitoring plan and a management plan. Now, we understand and appreciate that when such a requirement is created, it places the onus financially on producers. And we also know that the pork producers have themselves advanced significant resources in order to identify a pathway of these viruses and in order to identify vaccines that may potentially work to eliminate or eradicate the virus. And we also know that it's important and necessary for the federal government to be more than just a partner in word, but also in deed. So accompanying this order will be resources from the federal government. Now, these resources, when combined with what we're asking for in our 2015 budget, will approximate roughly $30 million. Initially, what will be available to producers and to the industry will be a little bit less than $4 million, which will go to additional research for the development of a vaccine. Several million dollars will be directed to state departments of agriculture through cooperative agreements to allow them to work collaboratively with you and us on these management and control activities. A little over $500,000 will be made available for developing these herd management plans that will be required by those who are impacted and affected by these viruses. Over $11 million will be made available in the form of a cost share opportunity for additional expenses that producers will incur as a result of the biosecurity measures that they will be required to take under their plan. We will also put additional resources into testing. Nearly $4 million combined will be focused on additional testing and genomic testing so that we get a better handle on precisely what we're dealing with. We recognize that it is important to focus on creating a better understanding of these viruses, a better understanding of how they came into this country, a better understanding of how to deal with them once they are here, and how ultimately to deal with the eradication and elimination of them. So we are putting these resources to work in partnership with the industry. This is too important an industry to this country, to the producers, to rural America, and to all of America, for us not to take aggressive action. Let me just simply say that it is important for the economy of this country that we continue to have a strong rural economy. And clearly, production agriculture and export opportunities are key and critical to the health of rural America. We have enjoyed record exports. We've enjoyed record exports in pork. We are expecting and anticipating to meet or exceed those records again this year. We know that nearly 1 million Americans are employed as a result of agricultural exports. So it is critically important that we continue to find ways to partner to deal with these viruses so that we can protect producers, protect jobs, and also protect consumers. It's also important for us to continue to work with agriculture generally, to take advantage of the Farm Bill provisions and programs, to develop a complementary natural resource economy that will complement but not compete with production agriculture. That means investing resources in local and regional food systems which allow producers not just simply to participate in the export market, but importantly for particularly small and medium-sized producers, perhaps to sell locally, a local school district, a local college. An institutional purchaser of food ought to be thinking about purchasing as close to home as possible. That's why we are engaged in a farm-to-school program to make sure that our schools across the United States are fully aware of actually what is grown and raised within several hundred miles of the facility so that they can incur opportunity and maintain profitability and income activity within their sphere of influence. We think it's important for us to continue to work in conservation, not just simply because we're concerned about soil condition and water condition, and we are, but because we see this enormous opportunity to expand habitat, to improve landscapes, to attract more hunting and fishing and hiking and biking opportunities in rural communities, which in turn create more economic activity. And at USDA, we're particularly excited about the opportunity to work with agriculture to take better advantage of whatever is produced during the agricultural production process. Every aspect of that process, from product to waste, can be used for a more higher value purpose. Opportunity for us to work with the industry to develop a bioeconomy, an economy that not only creates fuel and energy as is happening today, but also to expand that to chemicals and other materials that will not only provide additional opportunity, income opportunities for producers, but as importantly will allow us to establish bioprocessing facilities, good-paying job opportunities in small towns across the United States, using agricultural waste, crop residue, non-productive land in a way that creates not just income for producers but also jobs. This is an exciting time for American agriculture. It is always challenging, but there are extraordinary opportunities. And notwithstanding the current challenge that we face with these viruses, I think our brightest and best days are certainly ahead of us. We look forward to working with the industry, collaborating with the industry, researching with the industry to ensure that we not only get a handle on this particular virus, but that we work hard to do an even better job of preventing the next event. We know that we have a responsibility at the border. To make sure that we do as good a job as possible ensuring that what's coming into this country does not carry with it additional risks or additional challenges. So we look forward to working with the industry. Had a good, solid meeting with the board before this lunch today. And I think I know I've got great confidence in Dr. Clifford and his team working with the industry, and hopefully with our researchers, private sector researchers, we'll get a handle on this very quickly. So with that, since Howard committed me to answering questions, I will answer questions from everyone except Congressman King. He gets to ask them in Congress.
Just want to clarify, the media will have an opportunity to have some time with the Secretary after this meeting. So we'd like these questions to come from producers, and please state your name and where you're from when you ask your question of the Secretary.
Thank you for coming, Mr. Secretary. I have a question. As part of the Farm Bill, there was a plan for a study on a catastrophic livestock insurance for our hogs. I just was wondering your comment where that stands at this point.
Well, we have had to prioritize exactly what we are working on in terms of the Farm Bill. What we essentially did is before the Farm Bill was even passed, I asked our team to list all of the actions that would have to be taken to implement the Farm Bill. I think it was roughly 450-some actions, including the study that you alluded to, that would have to be taken. I then asked that each team within each title of the Farm Bill, the crop insurance title, the commodity title, the conservation title, to prioritize within that title what needed to be done first, second, and third. And then I asked a group that was representative of all the titles to convene, to come together to reprioritize so that we had a very kind of a master list of what we had to do initially. And that's why we started with the disaster assistance program, because that was the number one priority. And the reason we have to do this is because the same people who would be in conducting the study might also be the people who have to put together the disaster program, or the same people who are working on how the STACS program or the supplemental crop operation program is going to operate. So we've had to prioritize. I can tell you that the focus this summer will be less on studies and more on the implementation of programs that actually have to be implemented by this fall. The folks have to know what the supplemental crop option is going to look like. They got to know down south what STACS is going to look like. They have to know what ARC and PLC, how it might impact and affect their operation. After those very critically important work is completed, we will get to the study that you alluded to, and we will do our best to focus on it and make sure that it's a legitimate study. In that area, it's very, very important to get the numbers right, to have a good understanding and appreciation for precisely how it would work actuarially. And I've got confidence that we'll get that information to you fairly quickly, but I've got to be honest with you, it's not at the top of the list today, just simply because there are things that have to be done. We've got a new dairy program that we have to institute. That's pretty important. And then the other problem is that there's a funneling effect of all of this, because even if our folks approve something, it then has to go to our general counsel's office, has to be reviewed from their perspective, has to then be looked at by the Office of Budget and Management and Budget. So we make sure that we need to control that funnel, that we don't overwhelm it and it gets clogged. We will work on it, and I suspect that work will probably begin sometime later part of this year, first part of next year.
Mr. Secretary, my name is Craig Rolls. I'm a producer and a veterinarian from Carroll, Iowa, and I was honored to host your wife, Christy, on a farm tour a couple years ago. The American Association of Swine Veterinarians has identified about 40 other viruses in other parts of the world that could be potential viruses that we could be concerned about over the next few years. And this particular federal order is somewhat of a departure from processes and procedures that we've had in the past for like brucellosis and TB, and we all understand that there are, you know, plans in place for foreign animal disease, but this is a departure from previously procedures. Could you speak to the precedent that this might set for the future as we move forward with other disease introductions or potentials?
Well, Dr. Clifford would probably do a better job answering that question than I will. I'll try to give you a good answer, and then Dr. Clifford, if you wouldn't mind sort of amplifying that later if necessary. I think the speed of this particular virus and the multiple nature of it is of concern. When we went as rapidly as we did from where we were a year ago to where we are today, it's a deep concern. And our lack of information and knowledge about this, because it's relatively new, in a sense, creates, I think, an urgency for us to get a handle on it. I don't necessarily think you should read into this that this is the way things will be handled in the future. I think it is very much dependent on the circumstance of the time and the circumstance of the particular virus. In this particular case, we don't have a pathway. We don't have a vaccine. We're getting there, but we're not there yet. So what we do have to do, I think, is to see if there's a way in which we can at least, in a sense, keep it on the farm, help producers manage it, help reduce the spread of it, allow us a little more time to get a handle on causes and origins and so forth, and then hopefully work with folks who are working both at ARS and outside of ARS to develop vaccines that will work and that have gone through the appropriate testing process. I thought where your question was headed was basically how do we try to prevent this in the future? And I think, obviously, prevention is worth a pound of cure. And I think it does speak to the need for us to continue to look at the way in which things occur at the border, the testing and inspections that take place, and whether or not we are as prepared as we need to be at that specific location for the world that we are now finding ourselves in. And if we're going to go out and talk about the necessity of expanding trade opportunities, as we are, and the need for continued trade agreements as we are, then we need to make sure that those trade agreements carry with it the benefits and we reduce the risk associated with stuff coming into the country. So I don't think I would necessarily see this as a precedent setting. I will tell you that it wasn't something we took action on lightly, but we do think it's appropriate now and necessary to get a handle on where we are. Dr. Cliff, you want to add to that?
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Craig, I think the federal order itself, we wouldn't be using this type of approach in the future. But as far as reporting, we are looking and been working for a number of years with the industry and actually with the U.S. Animal Health Association on these type of events and how to better report. So we are looking at that, but we'll continue to work with you all in USAHA as we move forward on that so that we can have a better handle on these things. And there's other components of that that I spoke to yesterday that need to be a part of that, as well as diagnostics and things like that.
Greg Lear, Spencer, Iowa. Do we have any idea where the virus came from at a higher level, I guess, number one? And the second part to my question is, where are we sitting on animal identification long-term and tracking?
Well, I think it's fair to say that we are not confident today. I can't confidently stand up here and tell you that we know precisely where this came from. I will tell you that we are taking a look at how we might be able to more effectively track animal-human activity, feed a number of other items that could potentially be the origin and the reason. But I don't think we're at a point today where we can say definitively this is what the problem is, which is why we're putting more resources behind trying to identify that. It's why Dr. Clifford and his team are working daily on trying to figure that out. I would say that we're closer than we were a day ago or a week ago or a month ago, but we still have ways to go. On the traceability issue, we aren't requiring at this point in time quarantining or things of that nature. We just don't think at this point that's the appropriate step. I think we have good systems in place for the identification and dealing with situations like this, and I think we are able to convince the rest of the world that we've got good systems in place. But it is, I think, important for us to make sure there's a distinction between animal health and human health, because sometimes those things get confused on the part of some folks. Sometimes they intentionally get confused, and sometimes they are unintentionally confused. And so I think our challenge now is to make sure that there's a clear understanding here. This is about animal health. It's about producers. It's about animal health. It's not about human health. We obviously have a voluntary system we've got in place with beef that we're working through, and I think it's actually working pretty well. And I think the pork industry has been pretty good in terms of working with us in terms of trying to maintain and contain situations like this.
Mr. Secretary, I want to thank you for coming today. I appreciate your efforts at revitalization of rural America and also what you commented on working with the industry. My name is Jerry Foster. I'm from Missouri. You might recall a couple of years ago that Missouri, our commercial kennel industry there was suffering political attack from Mexican animal rights groups. That's a concern for me. In particular, I know the horse show industry right now is looking at some similar things. Now, I've heard discussion from people that the USDA at various levels has there's been a lot of uptake in animal rights and people that are associated with animal rights groups. In particular, let's say active groups, HSUS in particular. So my question is, can you tell us what assurances there are that the USDA is going to continue to be an agency that is going to work with people that are using animals, that believe in using animals for food, recreation, for work purposes, as opposed to the advancement of an animal rights agenda in the agency?
Well, I know what my responsibilities are. They are to the American producer and to those who live, work, and raise their families in rural areas. That's my number one responsibility. And I take that responsibility very seriously. And I think our work in access and expanding trade opportunities, our ability to work with expanded research opportunities, our work with this particular situation should reflect our concern and our interest in the priority we place on producers and their families. I have been a strong advocate of the Farmer-Rancher Alliance. In fact, I think it's fair to say I was one of the folks who suggested that that alliance be developed so that producer groups could come together collaboratively and cooperatively to send a single message about American agriculture. I don't know if you had a chance to see the movie Farmland, but it's a good film. It gives a good sense of producers. It focuses on young producers. It talks about some of the challenges. It talks about the great diversity of American agriculture, which I think is important. I think it is fair to say that we're not partial to one type of production versus another. As I like to say, I've got two sons. I love them both. Don't ask me which one I love the most, because I love them both equally. And I think that's an important message. I think it's a particularly important message given the demographics of American agriculture. The average age of the producer across the United States is 58 and getting older. There are 7 times more producers over the age of 65 than there are under the age of 35. So we have a serious issue here with trying to get people into this business. That's why we have focused and are focusing on efforts to improve opportunities for beginning farmers. It's why we expanded the amount of resource in our Beginning Farmer Rancher program and got one of the monies identified as one of the priorities in implementing the Farm Bill. It's why we worked with the crop insurance folks to create a different, slightly different premium system for beginning farmers, so it made it a little bit easier for them to afford crop insurance. It's why we are continually working for ways in which we can expand income opportunities for producers of all size. The local and regional food system creates a market where a smaller and mid-sized producer doesn't necessarily have to compete against a much larger producer that is, frankly, more efficient, has greater certainty in terms of quality and quantity, create a local market, create an opportunity to do business directly with your consumer, gives you a little more flexibility in terms of price, might be able to help that small, mid-sized producer stay in business. It's why we are working to expand income opportunities for conservation. We think there's an extraordinary opportunity there and are very excited about the Regional Conservation Partnership that we just announced, which we think is going to expand dramatically the amount of money available for conservation in partnership with landowners. So I think there are a lot of things we're doing at USDA. One of the frustrating things about this job is the portfolio of USDA. Now, Congressman, I'm not asking to limit it, but it is frustrating. On any given day, I can speak to a group like this. I can then speak to, and we can talk about animal diseases and research, or we can talk about exports. I can then go down the street to the local school, talk about the nutrition programs. I can then go further down the road and speak at a bioprocessing facility about economic development and job growth. I can then go down to a small town and talk about a new water system that we helped to install or the hospital that we helped to build. I can then go to a processing plant and talk about food safety. I can work my way up to Iowa State University and talk about the research activities that we're helping to fund, nearly $40 million last year coming from USDA. I could, if there were a forest, U.S. Forest Service property in Iowa, which there isn't, but if there were, I could spend some time in the U.S. forest talking about wildland fire challenges that we face. And then I could travel virtually anywhere in the world and talk about food safety or trade. And the reality is this department is so broad, we surprise people. You might be surprised to know that if we were a bank, the USDA would be the 5th or 6th largest bank in the country. We have over 1 million loans, home loans, water loans, utilities, broadband, hospitals, schools, fire stations, police stations. Nobody knows this. So it's really hard for the USDA secretary to speak to all of those audiences without some audience thinking that they're either not getting the attention they deserve or there's some other agenda at play. I'm trying to speak to the broader audience here, and I'm also trying to educate folks in suburban and urban areas. And I'll finish with this. how important it is for them to have a rural America. And here's what I said to the audience yesterday in Canonsburg, Pennsylvania, where we were opening up a Made in Rural America initiative to try to encourage small businesses in rural areas to export more. I said, you know, you all probably know that most of the food that you consume in this country comes from rural America. You know, the great thing about America is that you don't have to really import anything for us to survive as a people. You know, the only reason why we import is because we kind of like to have avocados 12 months out of the year instead of 6 months out of the year. We don't have to have avocados 12 months out of the year. We import for convenience, for selection, not for survival. Other countries, vast majority of other countries, they import for survival. Big difference, U.S., brought to you by rural America, by producers. You probably don't realize that maybe 50%, maybe 60% of the water that you consume is impacted and affected by what happens in the rural landscapes and the forested areas of this country, which represents 75% of the land mass of the U.S., and which happen to be located, for the most part, in rural America. You probably don't appreciate the fact that most of the domestically produced energy, regardless of what type of energy you're talking about, oil, gas, renewables, produced in rural America. You may not fully appreciate that when suburban and urban folks want to go out and have a good time and get away from it all, where the heck do you think they go? They go to rural areas. And then finally, I say, you also know that a disproportionate number of families send their sons and daughters to the military from rural America. 15% of America's population, 35 to 40% of the military. So all these kids who've been coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, substantial percentage of them come from small towns. I said, that's what rural America provides to you. Now, here's what else rural America provides to you. And I'll ask the audience, what do you do? Well, I'm a teacher. I'm a lawyer. I'm a doctor. I'm an engineer. I'm a veterinarian. So why are you that? 100 years ago, would you be that? 50 years ago, would you have had the opportunity to be whatever you wanted to be? Or would you have been like most Americans, working on the farm just to produce enough to feed your family? You realize that you've delegated that responsibility, pretty important responsibility of feeding your family, to someone else who lives and works in rural areas, who raises his kids or her kids in rural areas. So you've delegated that to American farmers. That farmer has given you the capacity, the opportunity to be whatever you want to be. Have you ever stopped and thought about that? And more importantly, have you ever thanked a farmer for doing that? So let me thank you for the opportunity to do what I did with my life, the opportunity that my kids, who were lawyers, have done with their lives, the opportunity that my wife, who's a teacher, has done with her life. Could not have done that 50, 75, 100 years ago. And fortunately for my family, they're not trusting me to produce the food, because I'd be a whole lot thinner. But I thank American farmers, because I realize what a tremendous advantage we have in this country. And I say to virtually every audience that you are a group that are underappreciated and misunderstood. But we in agriculture have got to convey that message, and it can't be defensive. We've got to educate. We've got to let people know. We've got to take not just pride in what we do, we ought to point out to the fact that we've created a lot of flexibility in this economy for people. And this country would not be as strong and would not be as free as it is today were it not for American agriculture. Thanks very much.